Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the 2019 Home Education Conference, held in Williamsburg, Virginia.
All right, my name is David Glassett, and this is C.S. Lewis Primer, or C.S. Lewis a Primer. Depends how you want to say it. So let me introduce myself just a little bit. Actually, I'm going to have you introduce yourselves in a way. And so I didn't put a bibliography of C.S. Lewis works or anything like that in the handbook, the guidebook, because it's super easy to just Google C.S. Lewis bibliography, and there's a whole Wikipedia page, and so I figured that wasn't necessary. So C.S. Lewis has written many books of fiction and nonfiction, essays, and all sorts of stuff. And I'm just curious, since this is a primer, some of you may be more well-read in C.S. Lewis than others, and there's no requirement to be at one level or another level. So I'm just curious what level we have here. So I'm going to go by fives. And if you can think in your head, have I read five or fewer books of C.S. Lewis? Raise your hand. Excellent. I don't have to ask any more questions. That was everybody. Except for the two that just came in. Five or fewer? Five to ten. You don't have to name them. I'm just looking for general.
I read them all. I have them in my house. And I thought, what a perfect time to motivate me.
That's right. That's why we're here. Okay, so it looks like we're a large majority at five or fewer, which is fantastic. I was about to fall into the next category, which is five to ten. Okay. Ten or more? No? Yes? We got? Of any of his works.
Yes.
All right. So there's various levels of reading here, which is great. And so you can share your thoughts, your impressions, your experiences reading C.S. Lewis. This is mostly to introduce C.S. Lewis and to share those snippets and really nuggets of wisdom that we can pull out from C.S. Lewis. Okay. So that was you. Thank you for introducing yourself in that way. So this is me. So my name is David. I am a cartographer by trade and training. So that means I make maps. So that's what I do. I love maps. I'm also a certified professional coach. So I do leadership coaching. I do it internally for my organization that I work for. But I've also done it for college. I've had a college student as a coaching client, small business owners, and things like that to help them create positive change in their lives. And it's been a fantastic experience for me and hopefully for those that I've coached as well. So this is my little company. I tell the youth when I put up the slide is because I really like my logo, and it also explains the rest of my slide deck, why it looks the way that it looks. Okay, so we're going to spend an hour together with these two objectives. And the first is to get to know C.S. Lewis and his works a little bit more. I'm going to share with you a little bit of his life story, and that might help you appreciate maybe where you are in your personal journey, faith journey, as well as appreciate what it is that he has done in his life in terms of the works that he's created. And then the second is I hope you understand and strengthen your testimony of Jesus Christ. We call C.S. Lewis a Christian apologist, meaning someone who explains faith and reason and belief. And so we're going to explore that all throughout our time here today. So let me introduce Jack for you real quick. And you may be wondering, who is Jack? Who is this Jack guy? So this is C.S. Lewis. This is a picture of C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis was born in Belfast, Ireland. It is now Belfast, Northern Ireland, but when he was born, it was still just Ireland. They hadn't made that split yet and joined the United Kingdom. And his given name is Clive Staples Lewis. So that's what the C and S stand for. So at the very beginning of one of his books, the Chronicles of Narnia books, this is The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. This was actually the very first C.S. Lewis book that I've ever read, and I'll tell that story in a little bit. He says, there was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. C.S. Lewis wasn't terribly fond of his name. And so it doesn't, I don't think it's happenstance that Eustace Clarence Scrub has some of the similar initials as C.S. Lewis, and he almost deserved that name. So when C.S. Lewis was a young boy, about 4 years old, he had a dog that he loved, and his dog's name was Jaxie. And Jaxie would be his playmate and the love of his little four-year-old life. Well, as has happened to many a dog, I think, through the years, Jaxie was run over by a cart and wagon and killed. And that devastated C.S. Lewis as a young boy. And he asked his family after that to call him Jaxie. And then as he grew up, Jaxie became just Jack. So if you were friends with C.S. Lewis, you would not have called him Clive or C.S. or anything like that. You would have called him Jack. That would have been how you interacted with him. So that's how we're going to introduce Jack here today. I'll refer to him as C.S. Lewis because, you know, I wasn't friends with him when he was alive. So I don't feel like I have that general permission. So I'll use a little more formal. So like I said, he was raised in Belfast, Ireland. If anyone knows anything about the weather in Ireland, the British Isles, it can be kind of cold and dreary and damp and like that all through the summer even. And so when C.S. Lewis was growing up, it was that way. It was cold and dreary and damp. And his mother had a belief that if her children, it was C.S. Lewis and an older brother, Warnie, if her children went out and played in the cold, damp, rainy weather, they'd get sick and die or something, you know, terrible like that. And so she pretty much kept them inside the whole time. And they lived in this house called Little Lee that was kind of this cobbled together thing that had hallways going this way and hallways going that way and you know, rooms and different passageways. And it was a kind of a young child's exploring dream. And you can hang out in the corner with your books or with your little stash of apples and whatever and enjoy your time there. And so because he was kept inside so much of the time, it was Jack and Warnie with their books, and he would write little poetry, and he would write his own little books, and it was kind of their little childhood growing up. His mom died of cancer when he was quite young, and his dad didn't know quite what to do with them, sent him off to boarding school, not just because he didn't know what to do with them, but because he wanted his sons to be part of that class of British boys who went to boarding school and got to go to what they called public school, which was different than what we think of as public school. Public school is actually private school in Great Britain. So at the age of 9 years old, he's sent on a steamship across the Irish Sea to Britain, to a school where the headmaster was very cruel. If anyone's ever read Dickens and Dickens' explanations of British boarding schools, whipping, beating, verbal abuse, that was this school. And it was an awful, awful, awful experience. Luckily, the school had pretty low enrollment, so the school had to close. I think there were only 10 or 15 boys by the time he had been there for a year or two. So the school closed. He and his brother got sent back. And he got to go to a school that was actually not very far from where he lived in Belfast, but that only lasted for a couple months because he got sick. He was always a little bit sickly as a boy. And then he got sent to another boarding school and then another boarding school. And so his fourth boarding school was called Malvern. Malvern was another awful experience for him for some of the same reasons, but other different reasons. So one of the challenges that C.S. Lewis had to overcome in his life was a physical deformity. So it was a physical deformity in his thumb. He and his brother both had it, and he couldn't move his thumb. Like, this joint in his thumb didn't work, which meant that he was really bad at sports. And that was the thing to do at this boarding school, is, you know, you were in the in crowd when you were in the athletic clubs. And so he was not in the in crowd, and so he spent most of his time writing in his room. But it was also a source of social stigma and he had to overcome that social desire to be part of the group, but he never did. He never could. And so that was a very, very hard experience for him. And it was at about this time in his life that he also faced a reckoning of his faith. So he grew up on the Protestant side of the Irish Protestant-Catholic divide. Protestant, but his family wasn't terribly religious in terms of outwardly. They wouldn't go regularly to church, maybe Easter and Christmas kind of thing. His dad really enjoyed the show and the pomp and the circumstance that went with some of the rites of the church, but he was not what you might call a believer. And so as C.S. Lewis grew up, he gradually moved away from any faith and started moving toward atheism. And so as a 14-year-old boy, his father said, it's time for you to be baptized, brought into the church formally through the rites and ordinances. And he went along with it, even though consciously in his own mind he knew he did not believe. And that struck him even into adulthood as one of his greatest signs of hypocrisy, personal hypocrisy, because he wasn't able to tell his father that, you know, this is not something that I want to do or believe in. So after he got out of Malvern boarding school, he was sent to study with a tutor. And this was probably one of the best educational experiences that he had before he went to college. In some of his books, he laces all sorts of things about education and school into them. And you'll see, especially in the Chronicles of Narnia, there's one character that he's talking to some children, the Pevensey children in the book, and he just shakes his head and goes, what do they teach these children in schools these days? And because he can't believe they don't teach logic and they don't teach reasoning. And it was under this tutelage of Mr. Kirkpatrick that he learned two distinct things. He learned a deep, deep ability for reasoning and logic. Everything that tutor taught him was, why is it that way? How can you tell it? How can you prove it that it is that way? And go through a logical reasoning. The other thing was also a very deep set belief in atheism. And so this tutor was also an atheist. And so those feelings and beliefs were deeply and deeply indoctrinated into him. And we'll see how the Lord is able to use that in his later years. So after he's done with his tutelage, the intent of the tutelage is to get into college. So he is admitted to Oxford, one of the most prestigious universities in England. So he goes to Oxford and he wants to study philosophy. So he goes and studies philosophy. He does very well. When you graduate from Oxford, you graduate with a degree of one of three degrees, one of three ranks. Or three degrees. So you get a first degree, a second degree, or a third degree. So a first degree is the kind of the exclusive, very top. Only a few percentage of the students get a first degree, and then everybody else gets second or third degrees. So he came out with a first degree in philosophy, which was great, and he wanted to become a philosophy professor. So he, went and put in his applications and interviewed around to try to become a philosophy professor, but got no takes on his applications. Nobody was interested in hiring him as a philosophy professor. So I said, all right, I don't know if any of you are in this place in college, but I have my degree, I don't have a job, what am I going to do now? I guess I'll go back to school and get another degree. So he went back to Oxford, and he got a degree in what they call the greats, which is essentially classical literature, Greek and Roman, and studying Latin and stuff like that. So he comes out with a first degree in the greats. So normally, two first degrees, super rare, is your ticket to a professorship somewhere. I mean, that is just the top of the line. And still, no takes in getting a job. So I've got two degrees, they're both firsts. I still can't get a job as a professor of philosophy anywhere. What am I going to do? Well, I guess I'll go get a third degree. I can't say third degree because that actually meant something. A third year of school. So he goes back, and this time he studies English literature at Oxford. And at that early 1900s, English literature is this kind of up-and-coming field, and people are trying to still figure out where are we going to go with this thing that we're calling study of English literature. And so he does English literature, and he comes out with a third first degree. So, you know, if he can't get a job with two first degrees, surely I can get a job with three first degrees. And he does. He gets a job at Oxford, of all places, but not as a philosophy professor, because that's what he was trying to become, was a philosophy professor. But he gets a job as an English literature professor. So he's now become an Oxford Don, and he is teaching students English literature. So he's very happy with this. He's content. He's still living a life as an atheist. That's his belief system. But he joins, as an Oxford Don, other influential or young influential professors in Oxford and around Oxford, and they call their group the Inklings. So the Inklings was a group of other writers and thinkers. Probably the most famous one that you've heard of is J.R.R. Tolkien. So he was also a member of the Inklings. So they would get together, and they would write things, and they would share their writings with each other, and they'd say, no, I don't like what you wrote. I think you should do it this way. Or they'd say, oh, that, you know, this kind of is good. Let's see, maybe we can develop it that way. And so they would have these discussions. And then they would also talk late into the night about various other things. And at this point in time, I've skipped over a few things that I want to fill in to round out the story. He had the influence of several authors that were really influential in developing not just his thinking as a writer, but also as a thinker. Now, the first one may surprise you. When he was a young boy, one of his favorite books that he would read over and over and over again was The Tale of Squirrel Nutkin by Beatrix Potter. He loved it. There was something about that book that just spoke to him, and he always liked and respected Beatrix Potter, but especially The Tale of Squirrel Nutkin. The way that autumn was described and just the earth, and it spoke to him. He also fell in love as a teenager with Norse mythology, and that he developed a bond with a really close friend at one of the boarding schools because of this love of Norse mythology. But this friend was a strong Christian believer, and he wrote the most letters to anyone in his life other than his brother to this friend, Arthur. The third one was he was traveling back to Oxford one time after a break, and he was at a train stand, and there was like a used book stand there, and so he was perusing through the different books, and he came across this book. It's called Fantasties by George MacDonald, and he picked it up, and because it has mythology and fairies and stuff, it was kind of interesting to him, and he didn't really know much about who George MacDonald was. George MacDonald was a strong Christian thinker and writer. And at that point, he excused that part of George MacDonald's life, but he enjoyed his writing and thinking, and it was okay. And then the next influence is during World War I. So he was sent to the front during World War I in his college years. And he got injured on the front only after a couple months. Being in battle. So he was sent to a hospital in France, and while he was convalescing, he came across the works of G.K. Chesterton and a passage of essays from G.K. Chesterton. He didn't know anything about G.K. Chesterton. G.K. Chesterton was another Christian thinker and writer, and who knows, if he would have known that, he might not have read it, but the way that he thought and reasoned through this set of essays that he read was also very influential to him. So he takes this thought pattern into this job as an Oxford Don, this group of the Inklings, which, guess what, J.R.R. Tolkien, who became one of his great friends, was also a Christian. But not only was he a Christian, he was a Catholic. And if you're a Protestant from Ireland, you're grown up being taught that you can't trust a Catholic. And so now he's got this good friend that he respects as a thinker and a writer who's not only Christian, but Catholic. And he's got other friends that were atheist friends, And his atheist friends have abandoned their belief in atheism to a belief in the supernatural, not in Christianity, but just that there is more in the world than just what science tells us can be reasoned by the five senses. And so that really shook C.S. Lewis, that he had his like atheist brothers here that now believe in the supernatural stuff. And so what is it that I believe? So he moved gradually from a belief in atheism to a belief in the supernatural, that there is higher power. And then he gradually moved from the belief of the supernatural to a belief in God, that there is God and he watches over us. And then he gradually moved from a belief in God to a belief in Jesus Christ as my Savior. And that was a very gradual process. It happened over several years. But one of the things that really, really cemented it for him, or made him really turn it over in his mind, was a long walk he had with J.R.R. Tolkien and one of his friends after one of their Inkling meetings. They were just walking around Oxford, and J.R.R. Tolkien said, "Well, you know, we talk about mythology and all these, the Roman myths and the Greek myths and the Norse myths, and then you've got Christian beliefs and the beliefs of Christ and the Bible." And he goes, "You know what the difference is between these mythologies and the Christian mythologies is?" And C.S. Lewis is like, "What?" He goes, "Well, the Christian mythologies are true. They actually happened." And that really made him really think it over in his mind. And it was actually, he can pinpoint it back, he was on a bus ride to the zoo, of all places. He was looking out the window, and that's when he knew. That's when the Spirit testified to him that this is true. And he had tried to be a successful writer before that point. He had tried to publish poetry. He had tried to publish essays. Nothing really took off until after he became a Christian believer again, stemming from his childhood. So that's the basic story of C.S. Lewis's faith journey. And there may be some echoes that you feel for you in your faith journey. There may be things that resonate. There may be things that are helpful for you in understanding where he is as a thinker and as a writer. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about his writings now. We're going to go through some of his writings. I'm just going to give you a big, broad overview. And if you've heard of them, and if you have a personal experience with them, if you've read them and you have some thoughts or comments you'd like to share, I'd love to hear what your experiences are with the writings of C.S. Lewis. Once we're done going through those writings, on page 179, I think in the guidebook, is a series of quotations that we're going to talk about, and we'll have some mini discussions. But those are all quotations that have been shared in General Conference. So all C.S. Lewis quotations that have been shared in General Conference through the years, and just helping us understand faith in Christ and the belief in Christ. And some of them, you'll notice, come from some pretty famous General Conference talks. One of them in particular, and we'll get to that when we get there. So let me tell you my personal experience with C.S. Lewis and some experiences I've had with particular individuals. So I think, as far as I can recall, the first experience I had with C.S. Lewis was Santa Claus, actually. Santa Claus would bring us one book each Christmas with our stocking. That was going to be we called it our stocking book. And so probably when I was maybe 10 or 11, I don't recall specifically, for whatever reason, I still haven't asked Santa Claus, and maybe I will. If I ask Santa Claus, she or he would probably say, "I don't remember why I gave you that book." But this was the book that Santa Claus brought me. It's The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which is book 5 in a series of 7 books. You know, I come from one of 8 kids. It wasn't like everyone got one of the books. No, it was I got book 5, and that was it. So I still have no idea why Santa Claus brought me book 5 in a series of 7 books. But I read it, and there are still principles from this book that stick with me to today. One of the principles that I absolutely love is the principle of forget about what other people think about you. You don't need to know what other people are thinking. You just stay true to you. So, even as a 10 or 11-year-old, that stuck with me and still sticks with me to today. So I read book 5, but I don't recall ever reading books 1 through 7 until I was married. So shortly after we got married, Kara and I decided to read through the series together. I think we had one small child at the time, and we were expecting our second. And so we read through them, and it was great. It was the first time I had read through all of them. It was amazing. It was wonderful. So much so that I strongly, at one period of time, we were expecting a girl, and I wanted to name her Lucy after one of the main characters. We didn't, but that was a strong desire of mine because we were reading the books, and I respected and admired that character so much. So that was my first experience with C.S. Lewis. I also remember at one point in time, I was on vacation. We were visiting my aunt and uncle, and I saw a copy of The Great Divorce, which is in here. I saw a copy of The Great Divorce just on my aunt and uncle's bookshelf, and I'm like, oh, C.S. Lewis, I remember this name. I don't know if it was from reading The Voyage of the Dawn Treader or something else. And so I picked it up, and I started reading The Great Divorce. I'm like, I don't get this. It's going way over my head as a 14-year-old or whatever it was. And so I didn't finish that. I didn't finish it. So we read the Chronicles of Narnia series together. Since then, I've read some of his other works and portions of them. We've read the Chronicles of Narnia series out loud to our children multiple times. I think we just finished our second time to them last year. And I've also really enjoyed coming to understand his life from some biographies. One that I really like is this one. It's called A Life Observed by Devin Brown. It came out in 2013. It's not your ordinary biography of he was born and, going through the steps of his life. It's a biography of more of his spiritual journey and kind of how that plays out in his writings, which is really neat. I had an experience at work, of all places. I went into the bathroom, and I saw this man who was holding a book, and I don't remember what the title of the book was, but it had a religious sort of title, like Finding God in America or something like that. I don't know what it was called. And so I just mentioned something about the book title and kind of its very overt religious nature, and so that got us into a discussion. About religious topics, and we were mentioning our various faiths, and he said, "Oh, you know what? There's one book that I read every year. Always, 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 I read this book every year." I said, "Oh, what is it?" He said, "It's The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis." I said, "Oh, that's cool." I've got another friend right now. In fact, he's read everything from C.S. Lewis, and he's read everything from George MacDonald. Fantastic friend and thinker. And I asked him, and I said, "I'm doing this presentation on C.S. Lewis. If you were to say which was your," and he stopped me, because you don't even have to finish the question. It's The Great Divorce. Yeah, that's my absolute, absolute, absolute favorite, C.S. Lewis.
Have you read it?
So I've not. I've started it. I still have not yet finished it, but it's a great story. It's a fiction-ish story. I'll tell you a little bit more about it in a minute. So those are my experiences with C.S. Lewis. I know there are others that love the Screwtape Letters. There are others that love so many of his other works. So let's go through some of those works. So like I said, he's done fiction. He's done nonfiction. He wanted to be a poet, but he never really got much poetry published. So I don't know. Maybe if you were to talk to him, maybe his one regret in life is he never got published as a poet. I don't know. I actually don't think he would feel that way. Okay, so let's talk just a little bit about the Chronicles of Narnia, if you're unfamiliar with the Chronicles of Narnia. It is a children's fantasy series, 7 books. He wrote them over a series of 15, 16, 17 years, something like that. They follow a group of, what originally is a group of 4 children that are the Pevensey children, 2 brothers and 2 sisters, into a magical land or an other world called Narnia. And so there's a lot of Christian symbolism. There's a lot of topics such as how do I overcome mistakes? Some of the characters make some really boneheaded mistakes. And how do I overcome them? How to follow the promptings of the Spirit, and for lack of other words, there's a very strong Christ-centered figure throughout these books. How do I move forward in the face of adversity? How do I overcome the kind of the sophistries of men and stand true to what I know is true? It's a great series. It's written at a very readable level. I think one of our sons read it as like an 8 or 9 year old. And obviously the more you read it and the older you get, the deeper you kind of get into some of the meanings and the symbols. But it's a fantastic, fantastic series, easy to read aloud to your kids. Any Chronicles of Narnia comments? Yeah, one?
Well, one of the other symbolisms is just the whole, the land where God dwells is light and beautiful. And, you know, that always, that picture in my mind of coming to this land that's really lit. And it always makes me think about returning to heaven where it will be, you know, beautiful and bright.
Thank you. So I'll just repeat that just for both the audio's sake and anyone in the back who may not have heard it. Is another theme is the land where God dwells is light and beautiful. And just thinking of that return to there when we get there. There's also commentary on death and resurrection in the Chronicles of Narnia in relation to that, the land where God dwells. Even before he wrote Chronicles of Narnia, he wrote something that has come to be called the Space Trilogy. It's another fantasy. Maybe this is why I didn't read. I was never a huge fantasy reader growing up, so maybe that's why I didn't read the rest of the series. I don't know. But I've recently read 2 of the 3 in the Space Trilogy. Some very interesting, more either, especially young adult or adult kind of themes. There's kind of an Adam and Eve sort of theme of the fall and kind of how do we reckon that in our own, in a different setting and how that works. An interesting take on some of those thoughts. Okay, so the Great Divorce. I've mentioned it a few times now. The basic theme is of the Great Divorce is it's a bus ride from hell to heaven, or from earth to heaven. And some of the themes are you choose whether or not you want to go to heaven. You choose whether you get off the bus, you can get back on the bus and go back to hell if you want. And so it's a really fascinating allegory. And he actually chose George MacDonald as a character in The Great Divorce as his sort of guide and mentor in the process. It's a really, really interesting allegory. Any thoughts on The Great Divorce? Another writing of fiction of his is the Screwtape Letters, and these aren't terribly long. Here, let me show you. Ooh, if I can get these out. So this one's The Great Divorce. I mean, it's not super long. This one's the Screwtape Letters, which is just slightly longer, but still not very long. So the Screwtape Letters are kind of C.S. Lewis taking the approach of what does it look like from the side of the adversary? And what is the adversary trying to do to break down believing thought? So Screwtape is a devil, if you will, or one of Satan's minions. And he's writing letters back and forth to his nephew Wormwood. And it's their conversation about how Wormwood can help this believing man fall from belief. And how can we get him to fall from belief? And so it's really interesting because C.S. Lewis at one point in time fell from belief. And he could very clearly see the things that happened in his life that caused that fall and helped him to overcome that fall. And so it's really kind of a clever interaction and clever way of writing. One of the interesting things that are in the Screwtape letters, it's, you know, if you go to church and if you can convince this believing man to not really pay attention to the sermon or think about how he's doing, but look at his neighbor and find something wrong with his neighbor. Maybe his nose is too big, or maybe his shoes are not shined, or, you know, start finding fault with your neighbor, then you've got him on a good path to rejecting his faith. And so it's just really interesting, like, oh, yeah, if those little things, by small and simple things, great things are brought to pass. If that's true for good spiritual things, you know, it could be true for negative growth as well. So any other thoughts on the Screwtape letters? Yeah.
I've listened to it on audio tape a long time ago, which isn't my preferred method of remembering things. But I think that's probably where sometimes when we're kind of at an impasse in our family or things aren't going right and we're trying to pull it back out, I would say, like with my siblings, my non-member siblings, I would say, you know what? Would make the adversary really happy right now when, you know, mom's passing away and we're stressed and we're not at our best. He wants to pull us apart right now, and we're not letting that happen. And so probably that's where I got the dialogue in my head. It's probably that.
Yeah.
So it's blessed me, even though it wasn't my preferred method, and even though it's been 10 years ago now. Yeah.
Still sticks with you.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I really like the Screwtape letters. It's one of, actually, I like Sue. But anyway, when I read it, I was thinking of how interesting it is. He says, just give them alternatives that they will like better. You know, don't tell them don't go to church. Just make it more interesting to go water skiing, you know, or don't tell them not to do this. Give them another option that they would like better. And then as the world, as our society is evolving and these things are happening that I feel are so terrible, it puts in mind a picture of a little devil whispering in someone's ear, you know, I'm not gonna get into any political controversies, but you know, these little things that are, you know, you don't need to pay attention to your divine nature of being a mother. It's more important to blah 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 or blah blah blah, you know, and taking away, making other things seem more desirable than what our creation was meant for us to be, and also just changing our viewpoint of why we're here. And I just keep thinking, it's this little devil going, hey, you know, don't you think it would be fun? Or hey, you know, you don't need to. Anyway, I have a very specific something in mind where I always think, how did we get to the point where the greatest thing we can do as women is now, it's my body, you know? And I just keep thinking, it's a little devil going, hey,
right. Yeah. If he can get that in a little bit here, then he can take it a little bit here,
a little bit
until that gets bigger and bigger.
I mean,
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
So he, C.S. Lewis also wrote nonfiction as well. He wrote lots of essays, and he also gave a series of radio broadcasts. So the BBC asked him during World War II to give a weekly radio broadcast about religion, of all things. And so he would give short segments. They were probably not terribly long, and not very many of them actually exist anymore. They're snippets. If you go out and Google, you can listen to just a couple-minute snippets of it. And so he would give these radio broadcasts about faith, and he wanted them to be the broader Christian faith in general, not Catholic, not Protestant, not any specific religion, but this is what we as Christians believe without getting into specific doctrines. And so after the war, he grouped those radio broadcasts into a book. He went and kind of rewrote them so that, you know, he broadcast them in more of a kind of a colloquial, very, not folksy, but, you know, I'm trying to be intimate with you, one-on-one, kind of fireside chat sort of thing. So he changed a little bit of the language so it was a little bit more formal, and he published it as Mere Christianity. So this is a very interesting and fascinating take, and you'll notice that a lot of the quotes that we're going to look at come from Mere Christianity. If mere meaning, if I were to strip down Christianity to its basic core and tenets, that's what we're talking about. Yeah?
I just want to say that's such an amazing book because of how he essentially reasons out how there's a higher power, you know, and then goes on to, kind of goes on to say, you know, like, why do we have, or it starts out, you know, why do we have this innate sense of right and wrong? Like, everybody is born with this, you know, that, like, this is my property, or this is my relation to someone's life, you know, certain, like, innate things, and, you know, we know that as the light of Christ. These rules that, you know, govern us are from God, but he starts out, you know, kind of trying to, like, have this, you know, reasoning of why there would be a higher power that gives us these, innate sense of, right, you know, right, wrong, and different, this law that is ingrained in us as, as humans, and then goes on to, you know, kind of, you know, gets on to say, like, this is from Jesus Christ, you know, and God, and things like that. And there's, I mean, there's a few times where, like, you're like, you almost were there, you missed the mark, because you didn't have the full gospel, right?
Right.
But it is amazing how close he is really understanding of, you know, yes, we can become gods and goddesses and this, you know, amazing power, and then Jesus transforms us. It's an amazing book.
It is. It is amazing. And it's in a lot of this nonfiction, especially Mere Christianity, that you see this very strong training in logic and reasoning coming out in defense of Jesus Christ and Christianity in general. And it's powerful because, as an atheist, that logic and reasoning told him this: my belief in atheism is not true. Logically, it's not making sense anymore, and moved him that way. And so thank you for sharing that, your feelings there. There's a book called The Problem of Pain that he wrote. It's about why, it's his reasoning through why God allows suffering in the world. So it's fascinating. I've read parts of it, but not cover to cover. So that's good. There's another one I don't have a copy of here. It's called Letters to Malcolm. It was one of his last writings of nonfiction. It has a subtitle that's it's all about prayer. C.S. Lewis probably wrote more about prayer as a subject matter than about any other particular subject matter. So this is, Malcolm's a fictional character, so it sort of bridges the nonfiction-fiction divide, but it's his writing fictional letters of true things. So I kept it on the nonfiction.
He
did marry, but he did not have any children. He had some stepchildren. He married a divorced woman. She died about four or 5 years after they married. She died of cancer. But he had, he adopted his stepchildren. So, yeah. So Letters to Malcolm is kind of his reminiscences on prayer. And then a talk that he gave at Oxford in his adult years called The Weight of Glory, which has since been republished in various essay forms. Fantastic, fantastic talk, if you can find a copy of it. There's a quote, one of the quotes that we have in the book is from that talk. And then the final one I'll add here is his autobiography, which is called Surprised by Joy. He specifically wrote it as his telling of his conversion story. So, you know, he doesn't tell it as this is my life, this is just my conversion story. So whether you call it an autobiography or a memoir or whatever you want to call it, that's what he wrote. So it basically ends, you know, he doesn't talk anything about his adult years after his conversion. And he skips some parts of his life that he says, you know, there's some stuff that happened in here, but I don't think it has a direct bearing on my conversion to Christianity, so I'm not even going to burden you with it. So I'm just going to skip over that part of my life. So that's his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. So if you've got your guidebook, we'll take the last 15 minutes and we will explore some of these quotes. I think page 179 is where we're going in the guidebook. And I would encourage you to find one or two other people near you and read the first quote. Read it to yourself. And if you've got a pen or something, you want to underline some of the power words, some of the phrases that are especially meaningful to you. I'll give you 30 seconds or a minute to kind of read and digest that, and then we'll come back together and share. Okay, if you want to share with the person near you kind of your thoughts, your feelings, the parts of this first quote that were meaningful to you, go ahead and do that now. Like I said earlier, these are all quotes that have been used in General Conference. So, for what it's worth. All right, we'll come back together. Thank you for your discussion. It sounded great. Was there anyone who wanted to share anything in particular, and particularly poignant to them? Any thoughts? Okay. Yeah, go ahead in the back.
So I liked the last quote, and you thought you were going to be made into a decent little cottage, but he is building a palace. And it just kind of reminded me about the atonement and how if we allow it to work in our lives, we ultimately will be made into a palace. If we let ourselves let Christ into our lives, follow his commandments, follow the teachings of the gospel, and even though we make mistakes, we can still be made into that palace and not this small little cottage.
Yeah, thank you. So this quote also makes me think of a story that President Monson shared that he read every Christmas called The Mansion by Henry Van Dyke. And so I've started reading it. I don't know if I read it this Christmas or not, but I've read it several times now. And the gist of the story, I'm going to blow it all here. I'm going to give you the moral of the story. So you've got this very wealthy man who donates to many causes and, you know, loves to have his name on the side of the hospital or the wing of the university that he paid for or whatever. He's doing it to get his name out there and recognition. And so this man has a dream or however you want to do it. And he's led through this land with all these mansions and it's kind of this heaven sort of place. And he's led through wondering which one of these mansions is going to be his. And he's like, oh, is this going to be the one? No, they walk right by it. Oh, is this going to be one? Nope, he's led right by it. And all these wonderful stately places. And then they come to this kind of run-down, ramshackle hut that I don't know if you can even get in. Like the boards are all collapsed on each other. And the angel that's guiding him says, here you are. This is your place. He goes, how can this be? And the angel says, this is all we had to work with. And so he comes back, you know, as with a deeper understanding of, I was doing this for me, not for the Lord and for others. So now you can go read the rest of it, but now you know the moral of the story. Okay, so let's do another one. We won't have time to go through all of these. How about we go to the first one, on the right-hand column. So this comes This doesn't come from a very famous general conference talk, but it was used in what has become a very famous conference talk. Okay, I'll read through it for the benefit. I realize I didn't read through the last one for the benefit of the audio. Sorry, audio. Hopefully you have a copy of our worksheet here. All right, so this one, pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man. We say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good-looking, but they are not. They are proud of being richer, cleverer, or better-looking than others. If everyone else became equally rich or clever or good-looking, there would be nothing to be proud about. It is the comparison that makes you proud, the pleasure of being above the rest. Once the element of competition has gone, pride has gone. So this, who used this? Anybody know who used this? And Ezra Taft Benson in his Beware of Pride talk. So, thoughts, feelings. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, the thing that I always think about pride versus being proud, you know, or Heavenly Father was he took pleasure in the choices that Jesus Christ made. And he even said, "This is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased." And I think of that as, you know, sometimes we say, "Hey, to our kids, I'm proud of you." But, you know, what I'm thinking with this is there's a difference between I think you're better than everybody versus I am well pleased in what you have done. Hmm. And so, you know, kind of the celestial version of what pride is being well pleased, because you aren't actually puffing yourself up or you're puffing, you know, whoever you're saying I'm proud of you, you're just saying I am well pleased in what you have accomplished.
Yeah, so the difference between well pleased and being proud, I think you're better than other people when you're really trying to say I'm just so pleased with what you have done.
Yeah.
Great, thank you. Two more. We'll go to the bottom right, the very last one. This is the most recent one that was from this selection that was used in General Conference. Elder Renland used this a couple of years ago. Some say of some temporal suffering, no future bliss can make up for it, not knowing that heaven, once attained, will work backwards and turn even that agony into a glory. The blessed will say we have never lived anywhere except heaven. So I think about, and I'm sure, I mean, we all have experiences in our life where we experienced some sort of suffering, some sort of agony. I think about, if any of you, our closing keynote speaker, Brother Denning, has shared some stories from his life. I think about a friend of mine whose father had ALS for a long, long, long time, outlived the general lifespan, and had many, many years of suffering. But if you asked her, would you have had it any other way, she would say no. The things that we have learned as a family and the way that it has brought us together, I would not trade that for anything. So we have never lived anywhere except heaven. And then the final one that I'd like to go through is the second one on the right column. That one was from The Great Divorce.
Oh, I mean, what talk John Harmon's talk?
The one we just did?
Yeah.
From Elder Renland a couple of years ago. About 3 years ago. Yeah.
You want to read it?
Yep, so this one is the second one in the right column. I don't recall who used this one in General Conference. God has infinite attention to spare for each one of us. He does not have to deal with us in the mass. You are as much alone with him as you were the only being he had ever created. When Christ died, he died for you individually, just as much as if you had been the only man or woman in the world. And we know that's true. We know that Christ died and suffered for each of us individually. We know that when we pray, our Heavenly Father has time for us individually. the science of quantum time and whatever. I don't know. I don't know how he does it. But he does. And I think about it often. I think about it every time my wife and I are going to bed and she's saying her prayer and I'm saying my prayer. I'm like, we're praying at the same time, but God hears us both individually and he knows us and responds to us both individually. And it is beautiful and it is amazing. And the love that he has for us individually is real because we are his children. I know we are concerned a lot about giving our time as individuals to our children. And he will make it possible. Because he does it for us. And he will make it possible for them. So thank you. I hope that you've been introduced a little bit more to C.S. Lewis, if you hadn't already been. And that your understanding and strength and your testimony of Jesus Christ are a little bit increased because of being here. Thank you so much.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.